I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Imagine spending 23 hours a day in a small cell for weeks, months, even decades with minimum human contact. Imagine the effects it has on a person's mind and body. Today, hear what we're learning about the practice of solitary confinement in prisons, why it's used, what rules there are for such isolation, and if states are beginning to rethink policies for using separation as a correctional method. Then, warnings that Social Security was running out of money have been sounding for years. Now, that reality is not far away. The smart money experts discuss ways to keep the program solvent and how you can maximize your Social Security benefits. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Most people understand exactly what solitary confinement is. It's being confined to a small cell, maybe 6 by 10, for 23 hours a day. Prisoners get an hour a day for fresh air. It doesn't take much to reach the conclusion that confinement like that can carry devastating emotional and psychological consequences. Taylor Pendergrass is one of the editors of a new collection of stories about life in solitary confinement, the book 6 by 10, Stories from Solitary. One of his most vivid memories is from visiting a prison in upstate New York where thousands of prisoners held in solitary were yelling and hooting and screaming. Taylor Pendergrass is a civil rights lawyer and strategist for the ACLU's Campaign for Smart Justice. Taylor, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thanks, Steve. Great to be here.
Why were all those men screaming?
When I visited that prison in upstate New York, it was part of an investigation into solitary confinement practices there. And we were walking up to the prison at a moment in time when all of the people who are incarcerated were being let out for their 1 hour of recreation a day. So a lot of those men had been held in, you know, the small concrete cell for weeks or months or even years. And this was the 1 hour that they got every day to come outside. And I think we were just hearing, you know, the emotion and some of the trauma of being confined in that experience for so long.
How did that moment strike you?
It was shocking for me. I, as a civil rights attorney who's focused a lot on criminal justice reform, I've been in a lot of prisons and jails to interview clients and to conduct investigations, but nothing really prepared me for the kind of cacophony of noise that I heard when we were walking up to that prison.
You know, today in America, do all 50 states employ some kind of solitary confinement method, Taylor?
Yeah, the tragic kind of story of solitary confinement in the United States is that, you know, really started ramping up in the 90s and has just become absolutely pervasive in, you know, in every jail, prison, in the federal immigration detention system, in juvenile detention systems, almost everywhere you look in every single state, there is some form of solitary confinement being practiced.
The state of Kansas is said to be moving away from solitary confinement. I'm not sure exactly what that means, but are other states doing something similar?
Yeah, there's been, you know, I think as a result of the movement to try to abolish solitary confinement in the United States, especially over the last 4 to 5 years, there's been some really exciting and hopeful developments in a number of states that have recognized that there are just far too many people in solitary confinement in the first place. And in the very rare instances in which you might need to remove someone from the general prison population because they're a threat to someone's health or safety, there's no reason to maximize that person's isolation in such a punitive and torturous way. So states like Colorado, for example, I think are on the leading edge of this reform movement. They've now limited solitary confinement in its extreme form to a maximum of 15 days, which is consistent with recommendations from the United Nations. And after that time, anyone who's going to be held in a cell by themselves away from the general prison population gets a minimum of 4 hours a day out of their cell, where they get therapeutic programming, where they might get some educational opportunities, and, you know, basic human contact that we all need to survive.
That's 4 hours a day. That's a far cry from the 1 hour a day that we hear that so many prisoners confined to solitary confinement end up getting.
That's right. I mean, to be clear, those are still very harsh conditions. I think even spending 20 hours a day in the cell for months or years at a time is still very restrictive, but it's certainly a step in the right direction. And I think it's only a step. I think that, you know, systems like the Colorado State Prison System and other places who have implemented reforms have seen the trajectory for long-term reform being a place where we are not subjecting people to the type of extreme isolation that we have in the past.
Well, why is it still used?
I think that there are a variety of reasons that it's still so pervasive. You know, one and probably the most difficult problem to get under is that it's, you know, at its core is a cultural problem within the state prison systems, but also within our criminal justice system writ large. You know, it's really designed to be a punitive system and not to be a rehabilitative system. And that's, you know, a change that and a transformation that happened in large respect in the late 80s and early 90s, when a lot of kind of tough on crime philosophy and policies were implemented. There was a lot of funding at the federal level and a lot of eagerness at the state level to build solitary confinement prisons that were dedicated only to holding people in almost complete isolation. And so the infrastructure is there. You know, the culture of punishment is very strong. Right. And I think in a lot of these state prison systems, they've just never done it any other way. So it's a big step to move away from its pervasive use.
In your view, is it ever justified, Taylor?
Well, as I said before, I think states like Colorado, you know, are showing that in very rare circumstances, you might have someone who is in a prison setting who is such an immediate threat to someone's safety or well-being, either of staff or other people who are incarcerated, that they do need to be taken out of the general prison population and put into an environment to protect people's health and safety. But even in those cases, I don't think the environment that someone needs to be held in should be a barren concrete cell with no books to read, nothing to do, no people to talk to, and certainly not for the lengths of time that we see in the United States, where people are held in solitary confinement, sometimes for decades. One of the people in our book was held in solitary confinement for 27 years. And, you know, I think that
27 years, what possibly justifies something like that?
Yeah, there's no justification. There's no legitimate justification for holding someone in that type of isolation for so long. And what's so sad and horrifying in many instances is that the people, especially the people who spend long amounts of time in solitary confinement, are often put there for very petty offenses in the prison system, or they're put there because they've been identified by prison officials as a gang member. And that designation itself is often based on very little information and is quite suspect. And then once they're in solitary confinement in many systems, there is almost no process to get out. Once you're in, you're in. And the other thing that we've seen happen with a lot of people who are subjected to these conditions, and I'm sure your listeners can imagine, is once you're being held in a concrete box that's, you know, 6x10 with no real meaningful human contact, things get worse. Things get worse really quickly. And people do things in solitary confinement that end up earning them additional time, and they've got no way to get out. And people just languish there for years and sometimes even decades. And it's a very tragic and totally avoidable aspect of our prison system.
So you're talking about some inmates chronicled in your book who have spent 27 years in solitary confinement. You're also saying the state of Colorado is saying that today the maximum amount of time you can spend in solitary is 15 days?
That's right. That's exactly right. And I think, you know, one thing not to lose sight of with this conversation is that about 96% of everyone who we incarcerate is coming back to our communities. They will be released. They will come, you know, back to Overland Park. They'll come back to Denver, all the towns and cities that we live in. And so, you know, part of the reason this issue is so important is because it's a moral issue, it's a civil rights issue. It also has very practical consequences for our communities. In a vast majority of states, people were often released directly from solitary confinement to the streets. I have clients that I represented in New York who spent 4 or 5 years in solitary confinement right up until their release date. And then they were given a bus ticket to go back down to the city. And how we treat people inside of our prisons, what services they do or don't get, how well they're prepared to come back to society after release is a critical question that we just haven't paid any attention to for a very long time. And so, you know, I certainly believe that solitary confinement is torture that we shouldn't be doing to anyone because it is inconsistent with our values as a society. But it also is a practice that has real costs and consequences for families who are on the outside and for us as community members when people return home.
We're talking about solitary confinement with Taylor Pendergrast. He's one of the editors of a new collection of stories about life in solitary confinement. The book is titled 6x10, obviously the dimensions of a cell, stories from solitary. Does anybody care about this, Taylor? I mean, we're talking about prisoners here. Is there any sort of significant public movement to sort of overturn this practice?
Yeah, I think in the last few years, we've really seen what's long been kind of a grassroots movement amongst impacted communities and their families to try to raise this issue, finally gaining some real momentum. And I think the reforms that we discussed earlier in Colorado are in part a consequence of the growing recognition of solitary confinement as a practice in all of our jails and prisons and outrage about the need of the practice to change. To be clear, we have a very, very long way to go. You know, in almost every place where it's being recognized. But, you know, this book is kind of meant to be part of sparking that conversation and detailing in people who have survived solitary confinement in their own voices, what that experience was like, who they are as human beings, you know, before they were incarcerated and after coming home in some instances. And it's, you know, it's meant to ensure that people have a deeper understanding of the human costs of the practice of solitary confinement.
Well, let's talk about the human costs. What do we know about the psychological impact of being placed in solitary long term?
Well, yeah, as you said in your introduction, I think that in some ways it's common sense, right? Anyone who imagines sure. themselves being locked in a room about the size of a closet or a bathroom can imagine how your mind would kind of start spinning out of control. What we know from the scientific community, from the psychological community, is that most people experience some form of, you know, psychological trauma after a very short time in solitary confinement, sometimes as short as 3 or 4 days of being totally alone, not knowing if and when you'll ever get out, can have immediate impacts. And those consequences just get more severe with longer amounts of time. And there's a psychologist in California named Craig Haney who studied this issue extensively with a number of different people who are incarcerated across multiple systems in the United States. And what he describes is a kind of psychosis that he has named SHU syndrome. SHU is an acronym that stands for Special Housing Unit, and that is the acronym that often is used to refer to solitary confinement units in jails and prisons. And, you know, that syndrome includes, you know, things like stress and anxiety and hypertension, you know, that constant and goes on for months and years at a time can become debilitating. And on the extreme end, of course, people engage in self-harm. People attempt and are successful at committing suicide after being held in these conditions for long amounts of time. There's no jail or prison system whose data I've ever looked at where the rates of self-harm and suicide were not higher among people who are being held in solitary confinement. And there's a little bit of a kind of a revolving door or an exacerbating effect here, which is that often people who are put in solitary confinement are people who might have mental health issues to begin with, and they're not able to function within the prison system. So they've already got a real need for intervention and therapy before they're put in solitary. And those needs just become more acute, and the consequences of isolation more impactful the longer that they're put in there. Often the availability to get any type of medication or psychological treatment is made difficult or even impossible in solitary confinement. So you can imagine someone's in the general prison population with a mental health issue. What they need is more attention, you know, more intervention and more therapy. What they end up getting is locked up in a concrete box where they decompensate very, very quickly.
You know,
and then I'll just...
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, finally, you know, as the stories in the book make clear, there are also people who spend years in solitary confinement, you know, emerge from that experience, come home, and they are, you know, there are neighbors, there are friends, there are community members, there are people who you could meet at the grocery store and talk to and have, you know, have a normal conversation with. But what I will say is that even among those people who are resilient enough to survive that experience, there's no person who I've ever met who doesn't bear the scars of that trauma very, very deeply, you know, and they will have lasting impacts in terms of their ability to be with their children, be with their family, be in crowded spaces. Like that psychological trauma I've seen universally in anyone who's spent any significant amount of time in solitary.
Solitary confinement is our topic. Taylor Pendergrass is my guest. The new book, 6x10 Stories from Solitary. You know, this book is full of these individual stories, Taylor, of men and women who were held in solitary. Tell us about one of them. Let's go to Brian Nelson. Who is he, and why was he in solitary?
Brian Nelson grew up on the south side of Chicago in the 50s in a loving family, but got kind of caught up in a gang life that, you know, was romanticized in movies and musicals in the south side of Chicago. And things got very serious very quick for him. And he ended up being accused of attempted murder and was sent to the Illinois State Prison System when he was just 17 years old. After being there for, I think, about a year, Brian was asked by a prison warden to help mediate a dispute between two different gangs. The Illinois prison system at this time, it was like the late 80s, was just notoriously violent and very overrun with gangs from Chicago who were controlling different parts of different prisons. And Brian refused to mediate that gang dispute. And so he was put into solitary confinement as punishment for his unwillingness to cooperate with the warden's request. And that placement in solitary confinement just began for him what I think can only be described as a hellish, you know, Kafkaesque experience of being transferred from one solitary cell to another in the Illinois State Department of Corrections for 7 years, where he experienced extraordinary physical abuse at the hands of corrections officers. You know, so his experience, I think, is among the worst I've ever heard. Brian is out now. He works for an organization in Chicago that provides legal assistance to people who are incarcerated. He's, you know, attempted to turn his personal experience in a path that can help others who are currently incarcerated or about to get out, you know, from solitary and are, you know, filled with anxiety about what that transition will mean. But his story is just, you know, remarkable and horrific and kind of illustrates all the worst possible outcomes in a prison system when solitary confinement is used in such a barbaric fashion.
You know, one of the worst aspects he told about was this story of being held in the Danville Correctional Center in Illinois in a solid steel box. What was he talking about there?
They had built in Danville, they had constructed, as a lot of other prisons were at the time, there was kind of a race to construct the most brutal, harshest possible isolation cells. And states all across the country were endeavoring to create these solitary confinement units that were, you know, as inhuman as possible. And in Danville, there was a prototype of this type of cell in the middle of a larger room that, as Brian described it and has been detailed in subsequent lawsuits, was exactly what he said. It was just a stainless steel box that had been purpose-built in the middle of this larger room, which I think may have had one slab shelf of steel on it to serve as a bed. And that was the only thing in the entire cell that Brian stayed in. And it was just an experiment, I think, in torture and trying to make those environments as harsh and as punitive as they possibly could be.
He said it was so cold, the walls of this steel box were so cold that when he would bump up against it, his skin would actually burn because of the coldness.
Yeah, that was like a very poignant and profound part of his story in his interview. And I think what that illustrates, you know, more broadly, this is true for everyone who I think has spent time in these conditions, is that when you're held in solitary, one of the overarching aspects of your existence is boredom and just extreme reactions to the most, you know, ordinary of stimuli. And, you know, in Brian's case, in Danville, obviously, I think, you know, he was put in conditions where it was freezing cold and it was purposefully designed to be that cold. In other places, though, you know, I think people do experience this kind of extreme reaction to temperature changes. To a lot of solitary confinement units will keep the lights on all day for people who are in those places, and like the disorientation of that experience, not knowing what time it is, and just having nothing to do, you know, nothing to do at all, but to be in your own head for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for weeks and months at a time. You know, people often experience hallucinations and other kind of forms of right. psychosis in those conditions.
You know, are there any federal standards of any kind that dictate how people have to be treated who are held in solitary confinement? What do we know about that?
Not enough. The Obama administration in the waning days promulgated a set of regulations for the Federal Bureau of Prisons that would have made some improvements to the way that the federal prison system practices solitary confinement. The applicability and continuation of those regulations, I think, is now in doubt in the Trump administration. And in any event, you know, while regulations are important, they certainly don't have the force of law that a federal statute would, or that other complementary state laws can and should have in regulating solitary confinement. So what we need to see is legislation at both the federal and state level that dramatically you know, shrinks the use of segregation, make sure that certain minimum conditions are always met in the very rare instances in which someone needs to be taken out of the general prison population. And you can imagine a regime like Colorado's being the basis for that type of right. law and trying to codify basically what's happened in Colorado and other states.
You know, Taylor, just a final point. You have an appendix in this book titled 10 Things You Can Do to Help People Who Are in Solitary. What are some of those things?
Yeah, thanks for pointing that out, Steve. There, you know, this is such a tragic story, and there's so much that people can and should be doing. You know, as you asked about earlier in the interview, I think just making friends and neighbors and other people aware of this as an issue is a really important starting place. I think there are very few people to whom I've ever described solitary confinement who haven't had a visceral reaction and outrage. And just letting people know that this is happening in our towns and communities, I think, is really important. There are a lot of opportunities to talk to criminal justice officials and other elected leaders, whether it's the governor or the sheriff who controls the Jackson County Jail, or other people who have direct influence over policies that can really have a difference in terms of solitary confinement. And there are a lot of examples of efforts in which ordinary citizens complaining to their local elected sheriff or to their mayor or to their governor have made a difference in this particular way. And then finally, you know, there are a lot of people who are stuck in solitary confinement with maybe, you know, few or no family members that they correspond with frequently. And there is a national program that connects people in solitary with pen pals. So that's another small but really critical thing that people can do if they want to pick up a pen and a piece of paper and write to someone who may not have any other human contact. That can be the difference, you know, between life and death for some people trapped in these conditions.
That's Taylor Pendergrass, one of the editors of a new collection of stories about life in solitary confinement. That book, again, 6x10 Stories from Solitary. Taylor, thanks for taking some time with us. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
Time for a break here. When we come back, our Smart Money team will be with us and we'll talk about the future of Social Security. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Crime has dropped drastically in the historic Northeast neighborhood of Kansas City. Hear what made 2018 there safer and listen to other conversations. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, different generations and cultures will be united through art at Kansas City's Mattie Rhodes Center. Learn about the exhibition highlighting the center's rarely seen folk art collection tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, if you're like me, you may be old enough to at least begin thinking about retirement and what that new reality might look like. Then you hear a stat like this one. Starting a few years down the road, if Congress doesn't act, I might only get 75% of my promised benefit. And there's this, the program is paying out in benefits more than it brings in. That doesn't sound too encouraging either. So what does all this mean for people like me going forward? Will the program even be there? Our Smart Money experts are here to talk about this. They are Lucas Butchell, is a principal with KHC Wealth Management. Lucas, nice to have you back.
Thanks. Good morning.
Barbara McManus, president of Innovest Financial Partners in Brookside. Barbara, good morning.
Good morning.
David Jackson is a certified financial planner, practitioner, and financial advisor for Waddell and Reed Financial Advisors. David, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
The information presented by our guests is for informational purposes only and is not recommendations or advice related to your personal situation. Please consult with a professional prior to making any financial decisions here. Well, let's start as we always do about with some current events here, Lucas. Time is running out for year-end tax planning. Just have a few days left. Do people, are they rushing into the office to figure out how to navigate the next few weeks?
You know, we do have quite a few people that do try to do some tax planning items here at the end of the year. So yes, most of them we've talked to before now and have kind of a plan in place, but we're maximizing retirement plan contributions, making sure that we're doing tax loss harvesting in their portfolios, especially with the market volatility we've seen. That's an opportunity that a lot of people have right now.
What else should people be thinking about, Barbara?
Well, they still have time to finish contributing to their health savings account, and that amount is $6,900 for a family this year, or if you're single, $3,450. So you can still max that out. You can also fully contribute to your IRA contributions, which is $5,500, but if you're over the esteemed age of 50, and I'm kind of looking around the table here, you can put in an extra $1,000.
Ah. David, are you getting a late year rush at your office as well? Is this what happens at the end of a calendar year for financial planners like you?
Well, yeah, you got a couple of things going on, and one is just the market volatility, and people are just kind of confused on, you know, where does this end?
Yeah.
And then there's the whole issue about taxes and, you know, how do I structure my taxes for the end of the year? So,
and you can help them, right?
We try.
Okay. Well, let's turn to our main topic here, which is this notion of Social Security and will the program be there for those of us who we want it to be there for? Yeah, let's start with the current state of the program. Lucas, run down sort of where we stand today and how concerned we should be about it.
Yep, so I think the big mile marker this year is that the program, for the first time, is paying out more benefits than it takes in taxes.
That's a moment.
And so that shifted into 2018 is the first year we've seen that. And so, you know, we keep hearing these projections about, you know, 2034, the program and the trust fund are going to be out of money. That's the point, really, without an act of Congress, you know, benefits would be reduced to roughly 75% of what they are today. So I think those are two things that have people talking, and rightfully so. You know, that even if you read closely on your Social Security statement, it says these are estimates and things can change.
I've noticed that line.
I think everybody knows that Congress needs to take action to make sure things get shored up. It's just a matter of getting the political will to do it.
I was going to say there usually you need some kind of deadline, Barbara, for Congress to move on something like this. How optimistic are you that we're going to see some action in the new year when it comes to shoring up Social Security?
Boy, it's tough to read the Congress that's coming in. I honestly don't know. And we're not at crisis yet, although the recent report from the Congressional Budget Office indicated that things have shifted. sometimes Congress just needs to get its back up against a wall. And the most recent change they made were 2015 to they tweaked some of the features because they were concerned that the system was running out of money and perhaps they could save money with these changes. I think it's a coin toss whether it'll get done in the immediate future.
And David, we should be clear here. There's not like some separate bank account of the federal government that holds reserve gold and bullion on behalf of the Social Security system. Do I have that right?
Yeah, you do. It's really just kind of a system of IOUs, and you know the people that are paying in are kind of paying for the people who are currently retired. So it's just, you know, playing with numbers. The issue that, you know, you've brought up on this show with us several times is the three-legged stool of retirement.
Right.
And we talk about people, their pension, Social Security, and their personal savings. And we all know that most people do not have pensions now. So then if they have to start worrying about is Social Security going to be viable or not, then you're kind of left with, well, what is going to hold up this three-legged stool?
Yeah, not much, right?
Yeah, it's not a whole lot.
I mean, are you worried about yourself as you sort of think about the idea of maybe one day collecting on Social Security?
That's a really good question.
I mean, are you worried about it?
No, I'm not. I'm really not. You know, I'm at that age where old people vote. You know, so it would be political suicide for our Congress to just let this program collapse and people of my generation not collect their full benefits. So I think it's fine for me, but I do worry about people like my son's age and maybe a little bit older, you know, the millennials and, you know, Gen Xers. They really have to be concerned because there are going to be some changes that are going to have to be made to make this program viable. And the sooner we do it, the better, the easier it'll be, the less impactful it'll be as far as taking away benefits. But
I was going to say, when you talk about changes, you're talking about perhaps lessening benefits for people once they do turn 65 or raising the age 68, 69, that kind of thing.
So there are a series of things that they can do, and it's probably that they'll do multiple things. But, you know, if you think about when Social Security was first started, back, what, the 30s?
FDR, right?
Yeah, right. But the average, I mean, they set up 62 as the earliest you could take benefits, but the life expectancy back then was about 62 as well. Mm-hmm. So now the life expectancy is somewhere around 80, 82. And so, yeah, they do need to make some changes. And, you know, that's one of the big ones. I'm sure they will push that age back.
But you're in the don't worry, be happy category. You think it'll be taken care of at least for your generation.
I am pretty comfortable in saying that, Jess.
As we sit here and talk about this, though, Lucas, it's lost on nobody that we have this giant bubble of pending retirees in the system right now. They're called the baby boomers, and it's going to be a huge mass of people coming off payrolls and going on to Social Security rolls.
Exactly, and that's really what when we talk about these numbers about paying out more than it's taking in, that's really what's happening, right? Baby boomers are retiring, they're taking their Social Security benefits. And, you know, a lot of baby boomers I talk to say, hey, we've earned those, we want to take those. And that's true. But I think what's happening is the number of workers to support the number of retirees is changing, right? That ratio is getting lower. And so if you can't increase the number of people that are paying taxes into the system, then you have to do other things such as cut benefits for people that are currently taking it. You know, raise taxes, right? Which is definitely, I think, a possibility. Or, you know, make other adjustments, which we can talk about, that'll help shore up the program long term.
I was going to say, Barbara, what are some of the things that maybe are in the offing here that Congress might turn to begin to shore up this program? Run down some of the options that are before Congress right now.
Okay, so basically, there are only two ways to fix it. You can raise revenue or you can reduce benefits. And as David said, a combination of these is likely. So one of the things that they are discussing is increasing payroll taxes on income above $128,400. Right now, if you make more than that amount, you do not pay Social Security on any amount above that.
Which is really kind of you wonder about that in terms of just basic fairness.
You do, and that's where the discussion lies. The notion is surely somebody making that kind of money can afford to pay more. And I was online using a calculator over the weekend and found that if you just raise it, if you actually took Social Security taxes on every penny that somebody made, you only increase revenue, or the odds of fixing the problem go up 29%. So it's not the total answer. They're going to have to do that in combination with something else.
Such as?
such as you can increase the normal retirement age. Right now, the maximum is 67. You can push it higher for your children, David. Sorry.
Right, I know.
Which is kind of sad. Kids, yeah. You can also, and this is really controversial, but it needs to be discussed, you can expand the pool of working age adults through new policies that encourage immigration. Immigrants pay taxes. They pay into that system. Whether Congress has the stomach to tackle that with everything that's
not
going
right
on
now.
With immigration. Yeah, that's a toughie. And here's something that not a lot of people realize. Social Security benefits are taxed if you earn above a certain threshold. Right. And frankly, the threshold is fairly low. If you are married filing jointly and making more than $44,000, you pay taxes on Social Security. So, and a lot of my clients don't seem to realize this. And so one of the notions is let's tax all of it. Let's tax a higher percent of it. So that's another idea.
But what about stopping the federal government from borrowing from the Social Security fund to begin with?
That's a tough, that money, you hear that, it's going broke, it doesn't really exist. But the government has an obligation to pay on demand. That is one of those things that doesn't make me particularly nervous. It's invested in treasuries, which is the safest investment on the face of the earth. And you have to remember that there's 12.4% of somebody's covered income still going in, a combination of the employee and the employer.
Lucas?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest misnomers with and misunderstandings about the trust fund is the trust fund is invested in U.S. government bonds, treasury bonds. And so no matter if Congress, quote unquote, goes in and borrows money from that and they put an IOU in there that says this is going to be paid back with the government bond, that's still just government borrowing, right? That's still government money. It really comes down to how much tax are they taking in versus how much are they paying out. And if there's a gap, Congress has to fill that gap with funds from the general budget.
Could the money be invested slightly more aggressively to begin to help with this?
It could be. In fact, President George Bush, George W. Bush, tried to go that route with individuals, saying individuals could choose to have a portion of their Social Security put aside and then invested. That proposal largely flopped. Individuals didn't really want to go there.
Especially after 2008 and the market collapse, right. That whole conversation just disappeared.
Right.
And so that is a third option to see if we can generate higher returns on those dollars. But that's really become a non-starter given the thing that happened after Bush brought that forward.
What else is on the table in terms of possible solutions here, David, as you look down the list of things here?
Well, you know, the real issue is, you know, you think about if you're on the highway driving 60 miles an hour and you see a barrier way out there, you got plenty of time to react to it and make some decisions. Mm-hmm. But the closer it gets, the more apt you are to make a mistake because you're making an urgent, you know, decision. Congress just needs to take this serious because, you know, as Lucas is mentioning, we have 10,000 baby boomers a day turning 65. You know, so it's going to put a strain on Social Security. We know it is. So the sooner we make some decisions on how you're going to correct the problem or adjust the problem. You know, so Barbara was mentioning the taxing Social Security. They did that back in the 80s when they first realized that Social Security was having some problems.
Yeah.
And they just said, well, instead of cutting back benefits, we'll just make you pay taxes on the benefits, which is a cut in benefits.
Right.
So there's certain things that they can do, several things that they will probably end up doing, but the sooner they make those decisions, the easier it's going to be.
Lucas?
One of the biggest changes and where you get some of the biggest impact is pushing the retirement age, the normal retirement age later, again, from 67. I would propose pushing it all the way to 70. Mm-hmm. Over a period of time, do it over 30 years, give people plenty of time to adjust their plans and react to it. The reality is we're living longer. 30 years from now, we're probably going to be living longer than we do today. And so understanding that dynamic, people should expect to work longer before they retire. I think the biggest question
working until 70 is a long time. You know, that would stretch me pretty good.
Yeah, I think
so
that's...
So leave me alone, Lucas. Is what I'm saying.
Well, yeah. I think you're safe.
You're messing with my life, Lucas. Yeah.
But people that are 30 right now, I think if you set that expectation and give them 30 years to adjust to it, I don't think it will be that big of a deal.
Well, given that the rules seem to be changing, given that there's uncertainty about the future of the fund, is that an argument, Barbara, to begin taking out your benefits as soon as you're eligible for them?
You know, there are pros and cons to that. There is no easy answer. You can take benefits out as early as the age of 62.
Right.
But when you do that, your benefits are reduced roughly 30% from if you took it at what's called your retirement age, full retirement age.
At 67, which is...
For some people, it's 67. For others, it's 66.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's some calculations that have to be done there. And then you get into the discussion about, should I take it at full retirement age or wait until I'm 70?
Mm-hmm.
And every year you wait, the amount goes up an automatic 8%, which, especially if you've been watching the market lately, 8% guaranteed return is a darn fine return. So what is early? Is early 62 or is it full retirement? Is it somewhere between or is it difference between full retirement and 70? It's a tricky question.
It's a mathematical question, too, that you help people figure out when they come
absolutely.
To see you, right?
Yes.
That's one of the things you guys do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, the trick is if we had an expiration date printed on our forehead, the answer would be really simple.
Yeah.
But we don't, you know. So
when you're going to die, you're saying.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So if you're thinking, okay, I'm probably not going to make it to 80 or anywhere past 80, maybe it does make sense to take it early. But if you're looking at your parents and your grandparents and they all made it into their 90s and you're pretty healthy, you think, well, maybe I should wait as long as possible because I'm going to get a bigger payout long term. So a lot of things to be added to that equation.
But at the end of the day, it's a guess.
It really is, yeah.
Okay, yeah, Lucas.
Steve, I think to answer your question directly, I don't think anybody should go out and take Social Security benefits early just because they're scared the program's not going to be viable.
Exactly.
I think, again, those are the people you're talking to that are 62. I think there's a super low chance that they are impacted substantially by changes that will happen. I think people under age 50 are the ones that have to worry. I think people that are north of age 50, I think the program will be there for them in a very similar manner or the same. And so I think if that's your sole decision, it's probably leading you to a poor one.
Hey, how do you advise people to go about planning for this decision, Barbara? When should they come see a financial planner? How do you walk them through this?
Before the age of 62. And what's interesting, and this builds on a point David just made, one of the things we discuss is their health. And so I can think of a woman that I was working with and on paper, it looked as if she should delay to full retirement age, which was 66 or even later. But there was a problem with health in the family, and she was already exhibiting the symptoms. She wasn't sure she was going to make it till full retirement age. And at that point, I said, take it at 62.
Right.
You just throw the calculations out because it's actually a life decision.
Mm-hmm.
It is a mathematical decision, but it's a life decision. So that's point number one, is discuss the health. Point number two is you look at the other assets. You pull in how much they have in investments. Can they support themselves while they're waiting to turn on Social Security? And that becomes important. If they have very few assets, maybe not. Maybe they need Social Security just to make ends meet. Again, you turn it on at that point. Maybe not at 62. Maybe 63, maybe 64. But you try to calculate that for them.
Right.
So it all fits in together.
We have a question here from Kenny who tweeted us this. What impact would a higher minimum wage have on the long-term viability of Social Security? I mean, could you see there being a positive impact as you look at that, Lucas?
I think it would have a marginal impact. So a higher minimum wage would mean people are getting paid more and paying in more Social Security
right.
taxes. So
that's
it would,
the idea there, I think.
So I think it clearly would help. To what degree, I'm not sure. I'm guessing it may make a little bit of a difference, but probably not a dramatic one.
How about some common mistakes that people make when it comes to managing Social Security? One is drawing benefits before their normal retirement age. David, we've touched on that a little bit, but that could be a big no-no.
Right. The multiple options that you have. So let me give you an example. My wife and I are like 5 years separated by age. I'm 5 years older than her. If I delay my benefit until I'm 70, I get a much bigger payout. Plus, I make a little bit more than her, so my payout from Social Security is going to be a bigger check anyway. So if I take it at 70, I'm getting this bigger paycheck. More than likely, I die before her. she'll just switch over to my bigger paycheck for the rest of her life. Mm-hmm. And so it's, in a sense, it's almost like an insurance policy saying I'm making sure my wife has a bigger check for her going forward.
You can do that? You can attach your wife to your benefit?
Well, she's automatically going to get a widow's benefit. You know, if my payment is bigger than her payment, she just automatically just switch over. So, yeah, there's a lot of strategies that need to come into play when you're thinking about it. Now, so the one thing I want to add before we run out of time, a lot of times people will call Social Security to ask them, what should I do?
And that's the wrong place to call.
Yeah, I've been to a couple of seminars where ex-executives from Social Security say they're not trained to give you advice on when is the best time to take it. They will basically just say, well, you can take it now and we'll have a check coming to you within 2 months, you know, but they're not going to really help you strategize on what the ins and outs. You need to talk to a financial advisor. And the question you asked Barb was really important. When should I talk to a financial advisor? And I'd say as soon as possible.
Well, why won't Social Security talk to you about this, Barbara?
Well, they will talk to you, but they have been trained to make sure that you have income and income as soon as possible. And that may not be the best solution. I think they mean well. I don't think that they're intentions are bad, but that is just how they're trained. And mm-hmm. so, and I'm sure all of us have had this experience where I will tell them one thing, but Social Security said something different. Mm-hmm. But I can prove mathematically, based on year by year income, that they will end up at a better place at age 70 or whatever if they use a strategy like filing on a spouse, like even divorced spouses can claim on a former spouse. That's something not a lot of people know.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, we've done that a couple of times with a great deal of success, and the attitude was, well, he was good for something.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go. What else would you advise, Lucas, when it comes to common mistakes here?
Yeah, I think one that we haven't talked about is widows. So if your spouse dies, a widow is entitled to be able to draw on their dead spouse's benefits, and also earlier than normal, as early as age 60, a widow can take benefits. So that's an important one for somebody that's lost a spouse.
You've got to start taking benefits when you turn 70, right? You don't have a choice at that point. You can't grow it any larger than that.
You can choose, but you don't benefit.
Yeah, be no reason not to take it.
Why would you?
70.
You max it out at 70, so you can choose not to take it, but why? It'll never go any higher. That's the maximum you'll ever get.
So there's no reason to wait then.
Yeah, correct.
That's correct.
But you can wait.
You can.
I'm not sure I get all that. But okay.
Well, one thing I did want to add.
Yes, sir.
I apologize. A lot of people will take it at age 62 thinking, but I want to keep working. And then there is a cap. So if you're taking Social Security early and you're still working, you can only make about $17,000 a year before they start hitting you with penalties where you have to give some of it back.
Does the same apply when you're 67?
No, once you reach full retirement age, you can make an unlimited amount and it doesn't affect your Social Security benefit. But if you're taking it early, prior to your full retirement age, then they will penalize you.
We're going to have to leave it there, ladies and gentlemen. Lucas Butchell with KHC Wealth Management, Barbara McMahon, president of Innovest Financial Partners in Brookside, David Jackson with Waddell and Reed Financial Advisors. As always, gang, thank you very much. Happy holidays.
Hey, Merry Christmas
to you.
Tomorrow, the local exhibition that shows the lasting impact of art is more than just for viewing pleasure. It also teaches history. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Devin Davis. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.